good horse, I called you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the...
You're listening to episode 615 of Unwelcome Guests, Granting Autonomy to the Logic of Money, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton. And this week on the show, we're going to continue where we left off last week, looking at the centuries-long historical process whereby money and its intrinsic logic, the ideas about interest, debt, whereby that came to seem so important that alternative ideas about hospitality, generosity, alternative cultural values were sidelined because money came to be seen almost as if it had a life of its own, as if it was somehow independent and autonomous. So we're going to be concluding the video that we started last week. We'll finish chapter 11 of David Graeber, and that leaves us about 10 minutes over, and I was wondering what would fit suitably in that slot, and I'm going to give you a recording which I made in Berlin speaking to a conference about altruistic economics. That's at the end of the show. So let's get started. This is the remainder of the video entitled The True History of the Banking Cartels and the Federal Reserve, and it's a recommended watch. If you'd like to download it and you haven't yet done so, you can do so from unwelcomeguests.net/615. But if you don't feel like a watch, doesn't matter, because I've adapted it for radio.
After World War I, the Money Trust continued to consolidate their power, specifically to strengthen and institutionalize their influence over government. They did this by forming the Council on Foreign Relations in 1921. The Council brought together the nation's top leaders in the fields of business, law, medicine, media, and politics. Currently, there are around 4,000 members. It was originally dominated by Morgan interests, with the Rockefellers gradually assuming more of a leadership role over the years. Its first chairman was, if you can believe it, Elihu Root. The Council on Foreign Relations is essentially a lobbying body, but one which wields vast influence. The majority of U.S. presidents since Franklin Roosevelt have been CFR members, as has nearly every U.S. Secretary of Defense and State since World War II. Most congressional leaders are council members, and important cabinet positions are also generally filled from the ranks of the council.
It's good to be back at the Council on Foreign Relations. As Pete mentioned, I've been a member for a long time and was actually a director for some period of time. I never mentioned that when I was campaigning for re-election back home in Wyoming.
The late Aaron Russo, an Oscar-nominated film producer who received but declined an invitation from Nicholas Rockefeller to join the Council on Foreign Relations, spoke about the organization.
I had a friend, Nick Rockefeller, okay, who was one of the Rockefeller family, and he, when I was running for governor in Nevada, he came to me, introduced himself to me through an attorney, and we became friends. We started talking about things, and I learned an awful lot from Mr. Rockefeller. Now, I was definitely being recruited, but it's more subtle than that.
Well, in your words, just go through the process, and then what he said.
Well, what it is, remember, we were friends, and he used to come to my house a lot. We'd have dinner, we'd talk, and he'd tell me about business investments, how you get involved in, you know, and was I interested in joining the Council on Foreign Relations? You know, I would have to get a letter to join them, but was I interested in that? And, you know, just stuff, you know, leading you on. And I used to say to him that I never really did that because that wasn't where I was coming from. You know, as much as I like you, Nick, you know, your ways and my ways, we're on the opposite side of the fence. You know, I don't believe in enslaving people, you know, and...
And he would come back with, oh, I do? Or?
Well, it's more like, you know... How do I put it? It was like, what do you care about them? What do you care about those people? What difference does it make to you? They're just serfs. They're just people. You know, it was just a lack of caring, you know, and that's just not who I was. It was just sort of like cold, you know, it was just like cold. And we believe that it's best for society to be ruled by an elite people who control everything. And I said, I don't believe that. You know, I believe God put me on this earth to be the best person I could be, and put everybody on this earth to be the best they could be, not to be a slave and a sheep to you and these people. And I don't understand why you want to control everything. What is the need for that, you know? And I asked them, do all the people in the Council of Foreign Relations feel the same way you feel? He said, no, a lot of them think they're doing the right thing. They think that socialism is the best way to go. But the people at the top, they all know the truth of what's happening. And that's what
so,
it is.
So it's compartmentalized within the elite structure as well.
Of course, of course it is. I mean, all the people that are in the CFR, was that 2,000-3,000 people? If you go to like Dan Rather, they don't know what's going on. They join the CFR because it's prestigious. They think it's good for business. It's good for this. You know, they don't know what's really happening.
One of the CFR's most world-changing accomplishments was their creation of the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA was formed after World War II as part of the Defense Act of 1947, a bill which also combined the departments of the Army, Navy, and Air Force under a new Department of Defense and created the National Security Council as well. This Defense Act was formulated by three longtime members of the CFR who also lobbied Congress for its passage. The first of these three men was James Forrestal, who served as the country's first Secretary of Defense. Harry Truman, who had succeeded FDR upon his death, was up for re-election at the time, and his opponent, CFR member Thomas Dewey, had been selected by the council to succeed Truman. James Forrestal met with Dewey, and they had agreed that Forrestal would stay on as defense secretary after Dewey's election to the presidency. But to everyone's surprise, Dewey did not win. Truman did. This was maybe the only time since World War II that the Council on Foreign Relations did not control the outcome of a presidential election. They made sure it wouldn't happen again, however, for after Dewey's defeat, the council has made sure that the presidential candidates from both parties were in their corner. Truman had ties to the mob, but was not a member of the council. He soon fired James Forrestal. Forrestal was later admitted to Bethesda Hospital for psychiatric treatment, and soon after fell out of a 16-story window. The circumstances surrounding his so-called suicide are suspicious. Why he may have been killed is unknown. Before introducing the second of these three men, it will behoove us to first fill in some gaps regarding the militarization of Japan and the rise of communism. After financing the Rockefeller and Harriman empires, Jacob Schiff turned his attention to Japan and Russia. Russia had long been a thorn in the side of the international bankers. Tsar Alexander II had sided with Lincoln during the Civil War against them, and the Tsars had long refused to allow Western banking to take root in their country. So the bankers began formulating a plan to end Tsarist rule in Russia. The right-hand man of Jacob Schiff in this endeavor was an explorer and expert on Russian and Japanese affairs, a man by the name of George Kennan. In the 1880s, Kennan traveled to Siberia, which served as a sort of penal colony for political dissidents in Russia, and began writing articles for the Western press and giving lectures across the U.S. describing the deplorable conditions in the Tsar's labor camps. Influential Americans like Mark Twain reacted with horror and became ardent supporters of political change in Russia. Meanwhile, Jacob Schiff began funding Jewish revolutionaries led by Leon Trotsky, pursuant to orchestrating a coup d'etat in Russia. Schiff's grandson related later that the old man sank about 20 million for the final triumph of Bolshevism in Russia. Paul Warburg's younger brother Max, who ran the family bank headquarters in Hamburg, also helped fund Lenin and Trotsky. But before a coup in Russia would be attempted, the bankers saw another opportunity to weaken the Tsar, which involved Japan. There is just no way around it. In order to understand anything about Japan, you have to know what happened there in 1600. In that year, after centuries of fighting between dominant clans, a large battle took place at Sekigahara, in which over 150,000 samurai fought. During the fighting, several clans switched sides, and Tokugawa Ieyasu and his supporters won a decisive victory. Ieyasu subsequently moved his clan to Edo and united Japan under what is known as the Tokugawa Shogunate, Tokugawa being the clan name, and shogunate meaning simply military rule. The emperor at this time became a figurehead. Three participants on the losing side at Sekigahara, the Mori, Shimazu, and Chosokabe clans, were ill-treated by Ieyasu and became bitter enemies of the Tokugawa. They would exact their revenge on the clan centuries later. Under the Tokugawa, Japan became a closed country. With the exception of the Dutch, who were given exclusive rights to trade with Japan through the port of Nagasaki, the country would remain off-limits to foreigners for the next 2.5 centuries. The Tokugawa clan maintained relative peace in Japan until 1853, when the American Admiral Perry showed up on its shores with a fleet of 4 black-hulled warships and demanded Japan open its borders to foreign trade, or else. Japan went into a panic. Fearful of an attack by these strange people with their modern weapons, the Tokugawa decided to appease Perry. This set off civil war in the country, for the Western clan saw this as a chance to topple the shogunate. They rallied their supporters under the cry, "Expel the barbarians, reinstate the emperor." Ironically, during the subsequent bloody conflict over what to do about the foreigners, both sides employed the support of the West, hoping to get the upper hand. France supported and sold weaponry to the shogunate, while Britain supported and sold weapons to the Western clans. After much bloodletting, the Tokugawa shogunate threw in the towel, and Emperor Meiji, a 16-year-old boy at the time, moved the imperial house to Edo and assumed power. Edo was renamed Tokyo. The newly restored emperor did not kick out the foreigners, as his supporters had advertised. On the contrary, the Meiji government went on a modernization binge, building railways, factories, power plants, and warships as fast as they could. Military advisors were brought to Japan from Britain, France, and even Germany. Then Japan started flexing its new military might in Asia, fighting and winning a war with China. This made Russia nervous, and tensions were raised again when Japan signed a military alliance with Britain. Finally, in 1904, Japan attacked and declared war on Russia. Jacob Schiff immediately went into action, arranging loans to support Japan's war effort. Money poured in from Kuhn & Loeb, M.M. Warburg, Deutsche Bank, and the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, which had been set up by the British after the Opium Wars. Not only did Schiff make sure Japan got all the money it needed, he used his influence to see that Russia got none. Japan's decisive victory over Russia surprised the world.
And as a quote from Encyclopedia Judaica, Schiff was prominently involved in floating loans, the most spectacular being a bond issue of $200 million for Japan at the time of the Russo-Japanese War.
It was no secret that powerful Western business interests exploited Japan's eagerness to modernize and her thirst for conquest to attack Tsarist Russia. Political cartoons of the day attest to this. Jacob Schiff even bragged about it. John Hammond was quoted in the New York Times, commenting on Schiff's boastful statement that the money of Jewish bankers had made it possible for Japan to wage a successful war against Russia. George Kennan boasted about his role in taking down the Tsar as well. He arrived in Japan in 1904, just as the war was getting underway, and with the permission of the Meiji government, distributed anti-Tsarist propaganda to Russian prisoners of war. He was later quoted as saying that, as a result, 50,000 Russian officers and men went back to their country, ardent revolutionists. Yet another straw was laid across the Tsar's back. In 1908, Jacob Schiff led a campaign to force then-President Taft to abrogate the U.S.'s long-standing trade agreement with Russia. Skeptics often submit that Jacob Schiff's campaign to topple the Tsar was merely a private crusade, but this is clearly not the case. In 1915, the American International Corporation was formed. On its board of directors sat some of the top financiers of the day, Percy Rockefeller, his brother-in-law James A. Stillman, and the president of E.H. Harriman's Southern and Union Pacific Railroads, Robert S. Lovett, all directors at National City Bank of New York. The company's founder was National City Bank's president, Frank Vanderlip, one of the 7 attendees at Jekyll Island. Other AIC directors included Otto Kahn of Kuhn & Loeb, Pierre DuPont, and the great-grandfather of George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker. The American International Corporation worked closely with another important company, Guaranty Trust of New York. Guaranty Trust had been built up on the Rockefeller, Whitney, Vanderbilt, and Harriman fortunes, but by 1915, J.P. Morgan held controlling interest. Guaranty Trust's list of directors was impressive as well. It included George F. Baker, Charles H. Allen, Rothschild Representative August Belmont, Harry Payne Whitney, and J.P. Morgan partner Thomas Lamont. The bank's vice president was Harold Stanley, who would go on to co-found the Morgan Stanley Investment House. In short, the bulk of American wealth and power was represented on the boards of these two companies. Together, they would eventually control dozens of multinational corporations operating around the globe. But in 1915, their first order of business was to pick up where Jacob Schiff left off, and in the final years leading up to the Russian Revolution, see to it that Lenin and Trotsky's Bolsheviks had all the backing they needed. Finally, in 1917, Tsar Nicholas II, weakened by George Kennan's propaganda campaign, humiliating defeat at the hands of the Japanese, and catastrophic involvement in World War I, fell to the Bolsheviks. The Tsar and his family were killed in a house in Yekaterinburg. Communism was born. How surprising that the second architect of the Defense Act of 1947 turns out to be George Kennan's cousin, twice removed, George F. Kennan. If you are confused by the fact that the CIA and their arch nemesis, Communist Russia, were created essentially by the same people, don't be. The Central Intelligence Agency was never designed to fight the spread of communism, safeguard democracy, or anything like that, despite the fact that the communist threat provided the justification for practically everything the agency did up until the fall of the Soviet Union. In truth, the CIA was created to do a very simple, specific job, a job to which intelligence gathering is merely incidental. Now, before introducing the third architect of the Defense Act of 1947, we really need to answer a few questions, which are undoubtedly nagging at you by now. What is it that the CIA was really designed to do? What is the real agenda of the bankers and organizations like the CFR? And what did Ford Foundation President Rowan Gaither mean when he said, as quoted by Norman Dodd,
"We shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union."
And finally, who are these people? Is there a so-called Jewish conspiracy, as some conspiracy theorists claim? And what about that other group often accused of trying to run the world, the Freemasons? Do they play a role in any of this? We can answer all of these questions, and more. But there's a little more digging we'll have to do first, so grab your shovel. When Tokugawa Ieyasu granted exclusive trading privileges to the Dutch, he wasn't forming an alliance so much with Holland as with the Dutch East India Company, which set up their first trading outpost in Asia just after Ieyasu's victory at Sekigahara. The Dutch East India Company and its main competitor, the British East India Company, were the first multinational corporations. They wielded the power of sovereign nations on the seas and generated tremendous profits plundering the far corners of the world. When people think of these outfits, they think of spices, and while it is true that the Dutch and British East India Companies imported spices and tea from the east to the west, the most lucrative part of their business was the opium trade. A Dutch West India Trading Company was also formed to profit from the lucrative slave trade in the Americas. To put it bluntly, much of what these trading companies engaged in was licensed piracy. Another interesting fact about these trading companies is that they were dominated by Freemasons, from the investors and governors down to the ship's captains. This is evident in the numerous Masonic lodges which sprung up along the trade routes. So how curious that both pirates and Freemasons are associated with this symbol. The skull and crossbones is a prominent symbol in Masonry. Here are some Freemasonic aprons. A skull, and usually crossbones, are also present in what is called the Chamber of Reflection, a room prepared for initiates undergoing the Masonic rite of the first degree in many orders. What few people know is that both Freemasons and pirates inherited the symbol from the same place, the Knights Templar. The true origin of the skull and crossbones is most likely the Chi Rho, an ancient symbol whose meaning is not morbid at all, but more akin to rebirth. The first Templar to fly the skull and crossbones, legend has it, was Roger II of Sicily, who harassed and plundered the coasts of Greece and northern Africa, and for whom the Jolly Roger is named. According to myth, Roger's father, King Roger I, copulated with the corpse of his wife Adelaide, Roger II's dead mother, and returned 9 months later to find only a skull and crossbones. The original Templars were Normans, the blood product of Franks and Vikings. The order was formed during the First Crusade, and with special privileges granted by the Pope, they amassed great wealth and power, operated a vast banking network, and built hundreds of churches and castles across Europe and the Middle East. They also maintained a large fleet of ships and dominated the commerce of much of the world. The Templar Knights had a good run until 1307, when King Philip IV of France, who was deeply in debt to the order, lit on the idea of wiping out his debts by charging the Templars with heresy. And so, with the consent of the Pope, his men began arresting knights. Many were imprisoned and tortured, and some burned at the stake. Most, however, fled, mainly to Portugal and Spain, Scotland, and very likely Switzerland. How interesting that the home of the Bank for International Settlements, the Central Bank of Central Banks, may well have been a refuge of these medieval bankers. Author Ernesto Frere explored what happened to the Templar fleet, which disappeared from the shores of La Rochelle when the hammer of King Philip came down. He concludes, like others, that many Templars took to the sea after their banishment, thereafter adopting a life of piracy. These skull and bones decorate gravestones in a churchyard in Temple Midlothian, an area granted to the Templars by David I of Scotland in the 12th century. Scotland is rich in Templar history, and some believe that the knights helped Robert the Bruce win independence from England on the field of Bannockburn. So what do you think? Does the flag of Scotland really derive from the cross of St. Andrew, as legend has it? Or maybe from this? Author John J. Robinson explored what became of the Knights Templar in Britain after their banishment. Robinson makes a strong case that the Templars simply went underground and evolved into what would emerge centuries later as Freemasonry. Robinson is not alone in observing many connections between the two orders. Various Masonic rites belied Templar origins, and the Temple of Solomon, which served as the Templars' headquarters in Jerusalem, is a central feature of Freemasonry. Maybe the best clue that Crusader Knights gave rise to Freemasonry is that Andrew Michael Ramsay, a prominent Scottish Freemason during the 18th century, said so in a speech given at a French lodge.
And there's a quote attributed to Arthur Edward Waite in The Templar Orders and Freemasonry. The Masonic Brotherhood arose in Palestine during the period of the Crusades under the protection of Christian knights.
There was already a large Templar presence in Portugal and Spain when those fleeing from France arrived. There, the Templar knights simply adopted different names. In Castile and Aragon, they joined existing orders, such as the Order of Santiago. In Portugal, a new order was formed, the Knights of Christ. The heirs of these repackaged Templar knights, who were expert mariners, contributed greatly to the dominance of Portugal and Spain during the era of world exploration. Henry the Navigator was in fact a Grand Master of the Knights of Christ, and Christopher Columbus, Vasco da Gama, and Ferdinand Magellan were all associated with these orders and flew the Templar Red Cross on their ships. This age of exploration was Spain's golden age, and then King Ferdinand of Aragon and his wife, Queen Isabella of Castile, did something stupid. They heeded the counsel of reactionary priests and started the Spanish Inquisition. As a result, tens of thousands of Jews fled. In the latter half of the 16th century, profound changes were taking place in England and Holland. Holland, known for religious tolerance, was a Spanish possession when the Inquisition began, but declared independence in 1581 and eventually kicked the Spanish out. Meanwhile, in England, the Anglican Church broke away from Rome under Queen Elizabeth. To wit, the Catholic Church was losing its authority in these countries, and that's where many Jews fleeing from Portugal and Spain went. And there's good reason to believe that at least some of the Templar remnant there went with them. Here's why. The religious convictions of the heirs and descendants of the Templar Knights, officially a heretic order, would have been suspect in the eyes of the Catholic Church. The Spanish Inquisition was not just an attack against Jews and Muslims. Any deviation from strict Catholic doctrine was grounds for persecution, and rumors of the Templars' Gnostic beliefs and occult practices had led to their banning. The Knights of the Spanish and Portuguese orders had developed a fruitful partnership with Jewish merchants in Spain and Portugal, who not only invested in voyages to the New World, Africa, and the Far East, but also played a role in marketing valuable goods brought back. Queen Isabella, King Ferdinand, and their successors expropriated property from the orders while the Inquisition raged to help pay for military entanglements, notably against the English and the Dutch. Maybe the best indication that the Templar remnant followed their fleeing Jewish partners is that as the Spanish Inquisition dragged on, Portuguese and Spanish dominance on the high seas went into decline, while that of England and Holland surged. This culminated in the establishment of the Dutch and British East India Companies, which both Freemasons and Jewish merchants played significant roles in. This notion of a Templar flight from Spain and Portugal to England and Holland is almost completely undocumented, but seems very likely and, if accurate, is startling, for it allows us to trace a continuous thread of conquering, plunder, commercial domination, and colonization. It begins with Rollo the Viking, who invades and conquers northern France in the 9th century. The Franks make peace with Rollo and his Vikings by granting them Normandy. A century later, Normans invade and conquer southern Italy and Sicily. Then in the 11th century, more Normans invade and conquer England. They are led by William the Conqueror, Rollo the Viking's direct descendant. A generation later, Normans and allies from all over Europe invade and conquer the Holy Land, at least for a time. This is when the Templar Knights are born. The Templars, in turn, dominate the commerce of the Christian world until they are banned and flee. From Portugal and Spain, they begin exploring the world and establishing trade routes, but are chased out by the Catholic Church again, this time fleeing to Northern Europe and England. There, they and the local Templar remnant, who will later come out of the closet as Freemasons, set up the Dutch and British East India Companies with the help of Jewish merchants and begin colonizing the world. The thread doesn't end there either, for several American families got in on the opium and slave trade rackets. Participating in the opium trade, we have, predominantly, the Astor, Cabot, and Russell families. John Jacob Astor we have already met. Remember Henry Cabot Lodge in Teddy Roosevelt's circle of warmongers? His mother was a Cabot. The Russells we have not yet met, but FDR's grandfather, Warren Delano, was manager of operations in China for the Russell family. On the slave trading side, two other Roosevelt patriarchs, Johann and Jacob, owned a slaving ship, the Expedition. The Browns were involved in the slave trade before they moved into banking, as was George Peabody, who ran the Georgetown slave market. If you think I'm stretching it by alluding to a connection between influential Americans like these and the conquering Normans of old, behold the roots of the following families. Peabody, Brown, Roosevelt, Astor, Taylor, Root, Russell, Cabot. Remember, Duke William of Normandy invaded and conquered England in 1066, winning at the Battle of Hastings. According to houseofnames.org, Peabody, Norman, granted lands by William the Conqueror for distinguished service at the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Brown, Norman, granted lands by William the Conqueror for distinguished service at the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Roosevelt, Norman, granted lands by William the Conqueror for distinguished service at the Battle of Hastings. Astor, Norman, granted lands by William the Conqueror for service at the Battle of Hastings. All of these families, and there are others, descend from a Norman ancestor who received lands in England from William the Conqueror after the Battle of Hastings. What are the chances? You may be wondering about other key players. The Rockefellers came late to the world domination game and are not Norman, nor are the Harrymans. You wouldn't find a Morgan on the battlefield of Hastings, for they are Welsh. But they have their own pirate in their history, this guy. Henry Morgan the Buccaneer was one of the first governors of Jamaica, which he used as the base for his exploits in the Caribbean. How interesting that the Jamaican flag, like that of Scotland, is a saltire cross. But that's not all. Green and gold happen to be the colors of the Morgan family coat of arms. Obviously, Jewish banking families like the Rothschilds, being German, had nothing to do with the invasion of England. There are, however, some surprising connections beneath the surface. This is the Stuart coat of arms. There have been over a dozen kings and queens of Scotland and Britain emanating from the House of Stuart, and plenty of Stuart blood flows in the current House of Windsor. On the right, we have the Hohenkrest. Frederick Barbarossa of the House of Hohenstaufen was the first of a long string of Germanic holy emperors, and Hohen blood flowed into other royal houses of Europe throughout history, including the British royal family. Now look where the checks on these two family crests originate, the Jewish House of Cohen. I'm not just grasping at straws here. The elements in family coats of arms are not established willy-nilly. The Heralds College, for example, has been tightly regulating coats of arms in England since the 15th century. Cohen is an alteration of Kagan, which meant king or priest in Khazaria. Khazaria was a large kingdom in Asia which converted to Judaism in the late 8th century, flourished through the 9th, and folded in the 10th. As Khazaria declined, two major groups there, the Magyars and the Kabars, migrated westward into Eastern Europe. Many, if not most, of the Kabars were Jewish. The Magyars, on the other hand, were really Huns, which is where the Hun in Hungary comes from. Historians invariably refer to these groups as Magyars and Kabars, and you'll never hear them talk about a massive Jewish-Hun migration, but that's really what it was. The leaders of the Magyar tribes were the Arpads, a clan which claimed to be directly descended from Attila the Hun, and who ruled Hungary for most of the country's history. Arpad blood also flowed into the royal houses of Britain through George, a Hungarian prince whose father was an Arpad and whose mother was a Russian princess of Viking heritage. George accompanied Margaret, an English princess who had been born in exile in Hungary, back to Britain in the 11th century, where she married King Malcolm III of Scotland. George's descendants are the Drummond clan, who not only married into the Scottish royal family as well, but became one of the wealthiest banking families in Britain. Two Drummonds happened to be the exchequers of the British Treasury during the American Revolutionary War and doled out the money used to pay for Hessian mercenaries rented by England from Hesse Castle. This money found its way not into the pockets of the Hessian soldiers, nor their king, Frederick II, but into the pockets of the king's personal banker, Mayor Amschel Rothschild, whose sons then used the funds as seed money to grow the Rothschild banking dynasty. Rothschild is an adopted name meaning Red Shield. The original name of the family was Bauer. An alternate version of this name is Bayer, and a Bayer or a Bauer was someone from Bavaria. If you take the blue and silver checks of the Cohen crest and turn them diagonally, you have the flag of Bavaria. The true origin of all these names becomes clear if you check the Scottish branch of the bloodline, Boer. The bow and arrow was the weapon of choice of the Huns, and this bundle of five arrows is an ancient Hun symbol. The Rothschild banking logo displays the same symbol. This topic is far too deep to really address here. Suffice to say that the ruling elite, be they kings, queens, or bankers, Vikings or Huns, Normans or Khazars, or Christians or Jews, have been colluding, intermarrying, and competing for 1,000 years to get control of nations and markets. This is why it is meaningless to speak of a Jewish conspiracy. Organized religion is for us, the masses, not them. They have a different calling, to rule. The word cabal actually derives from Kabbalah. The Templar Knights may have tried to pass themselves off as a Catholic order, but what they really embraced was Kabbalah mysticism, an ancient religious sect with occult overtones which predates Judaism. The dualistic nature of Kabbalah is represented in the interlocking triangles of the Magen David, which was used by Freemasons long before it became a symbol of Judaism. These are not Jewish temples. They are Freemasonic temples. And it goes without saying that the Templars and the other Crusader Knights were really the first Zionists, for they wanted the Holy Land, albeit for themselves. The Templars lost the Holy Land to the Muslims not long after they took it, but in the 19th century, two distinct Zionist movements sprang up pursuant to getting it back. One called for a return of the Jewish people to Israel, while the other hinged on a skewed interpretation of biblical texts known as end times prophecy. Some might be surprised to learn that there are far more Christian Zionists in the world than there are Jewish Zionists. One of the first proponents of Christian Zionism and end times doctrine in Britain was, interestingly, a Drummond, while one of the movement's first leaders in America was Charles Taze Russell, whose followers went on to found the Jehovah's Witnesses. Yes, this is the same Russell family that made its fortune selling heroin to the Chinese. Samuel Russell, the head of the family opium business, we briefly met. One of the original Templars may well have been a Russell, for one of the 9 knights who formed the order was a man known to history as Russell. This is very interesting, because another Russell of the 19th century, Samuel's cousin, William H. Russell, co-founded along with Alfonso Taft, the father of future U.S. President William Howard Taft, an influential secret fraternity at Yale University in 1832. They named it, you're not going to believe this, Skull and Bones. Now we get to see how the Bush family fell in with the Harrimans and the Rockefellers. Many are aware that former U.S. President George W. Bush is an alumnus of the Skull and Bones fraternity. His father, George Herbert Walker Bush, was a member too, as was his father, Prescott Bush. It was at Yale University that Prescott Bush became close friends with Averill Harriman, the son of E.H. Harriman, who was also a Bonesman. But the Bush-Harriman family connection actually goes back a bit further. Prescott's father was Samuel Bush, who would have been George W.'s great-grandfather. Samuel Bush was general manager and later president of Buckeye Steel Castings, a factory in Ohio controlled by the youngest brother of John D. and William Rockefeller, Frank Rockefeller. Buckeye Steel Castings made munitions and railroad hardware, the latter of which it sold to an associate of the company, E.H. Harriman. E.H. Harriman's son Averill had little interest in railroads, and instead of following in his father's footsteps after graduating from Yale, he decided to go into investment banking, forming W.A. Harriman & Company. He enlisted his friend Prescott Bush to join the company as a partner, and chose George Herbert Walker to serve as the bank's president. Walker was a well-connected investment banker in his own right, who was one of the directors at the American International Corporation. The year prior, Bush had married Walker's daughter, Dorothy. Their son, George Herbert Walker Bush, was of course named after Dorothy's father. Finally, we get to see where Brown Brothers fits into this quilt. After the crash of 1929, Brown Brothers merged with Harriman's Bank to become Brown Brothers Harriman. Time magazine announced the merger in 1930, noting that 8 of the 10 initial partners of Brown Brothers Harriman were all Skull and Bones alumni.
The 1930s. Wall Street hops into bed with Nazi Germany.
In the decade following the merger, Brown Brothers Harriman played a central role in funneling U.S. investments to Nazi Germany. Funds were transferred through the Union Banking Corporation, an affiliate bank set up by Harriman and an early Nazi supporter, Fritz Thyssen. The recipient of the bulk of these transfers was the IG Farben Company in Germany, the corporate muscle behind Adolf Hitler. IG Farben was run by its co-founder, Max Warburg, at least until anti-Jewish policies made it impossible for Max to remain in Germany. Rockefeller's Standard Oil of New Jersey also helped the Nazis prepare for war, providing IG Farben with a formula for making aviation fuel from coal, for example. Standard Oil escaped any serious repercussions from their cooperation with the Nazis, but UBC wasn't so lucky. The Union Banking Corporation was busted under the Trading with the Enemy Act and its assets seized. Many accounts of the scandal sidestepped the involvement of Harriman and Bush, but UBC's offices were in fact located in the Harriman Building at 39 Broadway in New York, and Prescott Bush and Averill Harriman's brother Roland were both directors at Union Banking Corporation. You can find their names listed here on Vesting Order No. 248, filed with the Federal Registry in 1942 in conjunction with the seizing of the bank's assets. Another major player in the funding of Nazi Germany was the powerful law firm of Sullivan & Cromwell. One of Sullivan & Cromwell's important early clients had been Standard Oil, and the firm had also helped J.P. Morgan facilitate his General Electric and U.S. Steel mergers. Two senior partners at Sullivan & Cromwell during the years leading up to World War II were John Foster Dulles and his brother, Alan Dulles. Not only were the Dulles brothers instrumental in the transfer of U.S. capital to pre-war Nazi Germany, they helped their clients, Brown Brothers Harriman and Standard Oil, try and hide their Nazi connections, albeit with limited success. Alan Dulles is truly a titanic figure in modern American history. He ran the OSS, which was America's intelligence arm during World War II, and the predecessor of the CIA. One of his brainchilds was Operation Paperclip, whereby German scientists and intelligence operatives were brought back to the U.S. after the war. Dulles sat on the board of J. Henry Schroeder Bank, one of the original investor banks in the Federal Reserve System, and a bank which was also instrumental in Nazi funding. Dulles also served as president of the Council on Foreign Relations from 1947 to 1950. The prevailing wisdom is that the father of the CIA was Wild Bill Donovan. Donovan was an important figure, but the title really should go to these three men. In particular, the third architect of the Defense Act of 1947, Alan Dulles.
And the other two men are James Forrestal and George F. Kennan.
Now that we've crossed that hurdle, what is it that the CIA was really designed to do? As the 20th century progressed, corporate America increasingly became involved overseas. The AIC Guarantee Trust Coalition was the catalyst for this growth, and they came to control no less than 200 multinational corporations involved in everything from the manufacture of machinery to international shipping to agriculture and mining. Frank Vanderlip stated,
"The way we conceived the American International Corporation, we had decided that what was needed was some kind of organization that would take a foreign business enterprise of great possibilities, or even a good idea with management behind it, and finance it into strength."
Over the decades, the face of Wall Street changed as companies merged, changed names, and vied for dominance. But the model forged by AIC and Guarantee Trust, one of global commerce directed from select boardrooms, continued. By the mid-20th century, the scope and breadth of this commercial empire was reminiscent of that of the Dutch and British East India Companies in earlier centuries. But there was a major difference. The Dutch and British East India Companies did their own dirty work. They had gunships with which to enforce their monopolies. Corporate America in the 20th century didn't have gunships. They relied on the State Department to grease the wheels of international commerce, and diplomacy was often less than effective. That's where the CIA came in. It served as the attack dog for America's corporate elite, protecting their interests abroad.
And there are two quotes from Secrets of the CIA by ex-CIA agents. Ralph McGehee said, "The CIA isn't really an intelligence agency. It's a covert action agency." And Vern Lynn said, "You don't look at people as human beings. They're nothing but pieces on the chessboard."
The CIA's first major operation was in Iran in 1953, ousting democratically elected Mohammad Mossadegh in a coup d'etat. The benefactors of this coup in Iran were largely British oil interests, but the CIA's next adventure, a coup in Guatemala in 1954, protected the interests of United Fruit, a company which had grown large under the umbrella of the American International Corporation. Another flagrant example of the use of the CIA as a gunship of industry was its ousting of Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. Allende was killed and replaced with Pinochet, one of the most brutal dictators in modern Latin American history. The coup in Chile was orchestrated largely in response to efforts by Allende to nationalize the country's copper mines and telegraph and telephone networks. This threatened the interests of AT&T as well as the mining giants Kennecott and Anaconda Copper. CIA interventions and coups around the world between the agency's inception and the first Gulf War averaged nearly one a year and included meddling in Ecuador, the Dominican Republic, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Brazil, Greece, Iraq, Zaire, Angola, Bolivia, Afghanistan, Honduras, and Haiti. The most infamous of CIA-backed coups was in resource-rich Indonesia in 1965, where Sukarno was overthrown by Suharto. After the takeover, Suharto's troops murdered over a half million alleged PKI party sympathizers with the aid of intelligence supplied by the CIA. The tragedy of all this chaos and killing is compounded when you factor in that much of it was paid for by U.S. taxpayers. Hypnotized by the perceived communist threat and clueless as to how big business really pulled the strings in Washington and Langley, Virginia.
Now replace communist with terrorist, and does that describe where we are at the 21st century, where terrorism is defined so broadly as to be basically anybody who disagrees with the status quo and with the autonomy of money? I'm an optimist, so I would say no. I would say increasingly people are aware of the psychopathic acts which are done in their name and in the name of money. That interest must be repaid. No, your children's life is not important. Our interest is important. I think increasingly people are aware of this, and as evidence, I would cite not just the rise in popularity of alternative ideas as used by the internet. I think that's been a key factor. I would look at the increasing militarization of law enforcement. Why have they got rockets on the roofs of London flats during the Olympics? Are they trying to make a point? The point I think they're trying to make is it doesn't matter what you believe, whether you agree with what's going on. We're going to rule you by force. And historically, I don't think that's going to work. I think it's what empires do when they're on the slide. Certainly, I don't think it's going to work internationally. The US might be able to control its populace as a military dictatorship. I hope not. I certainly don't think it's going to keep ruling the world and extracting the world's raw materials on that basis, however many military bases it's got, for want of a nail and all that. So, I'm wandering off topic here, but no, this is related to money, because the logic of money is what's providing a cloak for this incipient militarization, the private armies. Why do people shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's the power of the market? What is this power if it eclipses what individuals actually want? Why are so many people engaged in doing things they don't want to do? Well, they're saying, I have to make ends meet. This is the autonomy of money, which has come to curtail people's decision making. I think we need to understand how that happened in order to re-envisage alternatives. So, we rejoin David Graeber. There was a real revolution underway, the issuing of paper money by this nationally granted monopoly, the Bank of England. But, for whatever reason, public discussion had missed the point. They were talking about coins. They were talking about silver. So we rejoin David Graeber's debt, the first 5,000 years. This is the conclusion of the penultimate chapter, chapter 11. The 1690s were a time of crisis for British coinage. The value of silver had risen so high that the new British coins, the mint had recently developed the milled edge, familiar from coins nowadays, which made them clip-proof, were actually worth less than their silver content, with predictable results. Proper silver coins vanished. All that remained in circulation were the old clipped ones, and these were becoming increasingly scarce. Something had to be done. A war of pamphlets ensued, which came to a head in 1695, 1 year after the founding of the bank. Charles Davenant's essay on credit, which I've already cited, was actually part of this particular pamphlet war. He proposed that Britain move to a pure credit money based on public trust, and he was ignored. The Treasury proposed to call in the coinage and reissue it at a 20-25% lower weight, so as to bring it back to the market price for silver. Many who supported this position took explicitly chartalist positions, insisting that silver has no intrinsic value anyway, and that money is simply a measure established by the state. The man who won the argument, however, was John Locke, the liberal philosopher, at that time acting as adviser to Sir Isaac Newton, then Warden of the Mint. And Locke insisted that one can no more make a small piece of silver worth more by relabeling it a shilling than one can make a short man taller by declaring there are now 15 inches in a foot. Gold and silver had a value recognized by everyone on earth. The government stamp simply attested to the weight and purity of a coin. And, as he added in words veritably shivering with indignation, for governments to tamper with this for their own advantage was just as criminal as the coin clippers themselves. Quote,
"The use and end of the public stamp is only to be a guard and voucher of the quality of silver which men contract for, and the injury done to the public faith in this point is that which in clipping and false coining heightens the robbery into treason." Unquote.
Therefore, he argued, the only recourse was to recall the currency and re-strike it at exactly the same value that it had before. Now, this was done, and the results were disastrous. In the years immediately following, there was almost no coinage in circulation. Prices and wages collapsed, there was hunger and unrest. Only the wealthy were insulated, since they were able to take advantage of the new credit money, trading back and forth portions of the king's debt in the form of banknotes. The value of these notes, too, fluctuated a bit at first, but eventually stabilized once they were made redeemable in precious metals. For the rest, the situation only really improved once paper money, and eventually smaller denomination currency, became more widely available. The reforms proceeded top-down, and very slowly, but they did proceed, and they gradually came to create the world where even ordinary, everyday transactions with butchers and bakers were carried out in polite, impersonal terms, with small change, and therefore it became possible to imagine everyday life itself as a matter of self-interested calculation. It's easy enough to see why Locke would adopt the position that he did. He was a scientific materialist. For him, faith in government, as in the quote above, was not the citizen's belief that the government will keep its promises, but simply that it won't lie to them, that it would, like a good scientist, give them accurate information, and who wanted to see that human behaviour as founded in natural laws like that, like the laws of physics that Newton had so recently described, were higher than those of any mere government. The real question as to why the British government agreed with him and resolutely stuck to this position despite all the immediate disasters. Soon afterward, in fact, Britain adopted the gold standard in 1717, and the British Empire maintained it, and with it the notion that gold and silver were money, down to its final days. True, Locke's materialism also came to be broadly accepted, even to be the watchword of the age. Mainly, though, the reliance on gold and silver seemed to provide the only check on the dangers involved with the new forms of credit money, which multiplied very quickly, especially once ordinary banks were allowed to create money too. It soon became apparent that financial speculation, unmoored from any legal or community constraints, was capable of producing results that seemed to verge on insanity. The Dutch Republic, which pioneered the development of stock markets, had already experienced this in the tulip mania of 1637, the first of a series of speculative bubbles, as they came to be known, in which future prices would first be bid through the ceiling by investors and then collapse. A whole series of such bubbles hit the London stock markets in the 1690s, in almost every case built around a new joint stock corporation formed in imitation of the East India Company around some prospective colonial venture. The famous South Sea Bubble in 1720, in which a newly formed trading company granted a monopoly of trade with the Spanish colonies, bought up a considerable portion of the British national debt, and saw its shares briefly skyrocket before collapsing in ignominy, was only the culmination. Its collapse was followed the next year by the collapse of John Law's famous Banque Royale in France, another central bank experiment, similar to the Bank of England, that grew so quickly that within a few years it had absorbed all the French colonial trading companies and most of the French crown's own debt, issuing its own paper money, before crashing into nothingness in 1721, sending its chief executive fleeing for his life. In each case, this was followed by legislation in Britain to forbid the creation of new joint stock companies, other than for the building of turnpikes and canals, and in France to eliminate paper money based in government debt entirely. It's unsurprising, then, that Newtonian economics, if we may call it that, the assumption that one cannot simply create money, or even really tinker with it, came to be accepted by almost everyone. There had to be some solid material foundation to all this, or the entire system would go insane. True, economists were to spend centuries arguing about what that foundation might be. Was it really gold, or was it land, human labour, the utility or desirability of commodities in general? But almost no one returned to anything like the Aristotelian view. Another way to look at this might be to say that the New Age came to be increasingly uncomfortable with the political nature of money. Politics, after all, is the art of persuasion. The political is that dimension of social life in which things really do become true, if enough people believe them. The problem is that in order to play the game effectively, one can never acknowledge this. It may be true that if I could convince everyone in the world that I was the King of France, I would in fact become the King of France. But it would never work if I were to admit that this was the only basis of my claim. In this sense, politics is very similar to magic. One reason both politics and magic tend, just about everywhere, to be surrounded by a certain halo of fraud. These suspicions were widely vaunted at the time. In 1711, the satirical essayist Joseph Addison penned a little fantasy about the Bank of England's, and as a result, the British monetary system's, dependence on public faith in the political stability of the throne. By the way, the Act of Settlement of 1701 was the bill that guaranteed the royal succession, and a sponge was a popular symbol for default. Recounting a dream, he said, quote,
"I saw public credit set on her throne in the grocer's hall, the great charter over her head, the Act of Settlement full in her view. Her touch turned everything to gold. Behind her seat, bags filled with coin were piled up to the ceiling. On her right, the door flies open. The pretender rushes in, a sponge in one hand, and in the other a sword, which he shakes at the Act of Settlement. The beautiful queen sinks down, fainting. The spell by which she has turned all things around her into treasure is broken. The money bags shrink like pricked bladders. The piles of gold pieces are turned into bundles of rags or faggots of wooden tallies."
Unquote. If one doesn't believe in the king, then the money vanishes with him. Thus kings, magicians, markets, and alchemists all fused in the public imagination during this era, and we still talk about the alchemy of the market, or financial magicians. Well, this is the perfect lead-in from David Graeber to let you know, unless you're a real old-timer, you might not have heard of a series called The Wizards of Money. This is how I first discovered Unwelcome Guests, looking for this show. It was made approximately a decade ago by a financial insider. She did so anonymously, to avoid repercussions in her day job. She somehow stepped out of the blinkers of her profession and said, what is this money stuff anyway? What's the impact of money on the real world? Smithy, if you're listening, I salute you. It was your work with Wizards of Money that turned me on to money as a crucial topic. So if you would like to hear more of that, all episodes are archived in the Unwelcome Guests website, or you could go to your favourite search engine and type Wizards of Money. Now, back to David Graeber. In Goethe's Faust, 1808, he actually has his hero, in his capacity as alchemist-magician, pay a visit to the Holy Roman Emperor. The Emperor's sinking under the weight of endless debts that he's piled up, paying for the extravagant pleasures of his court. Faust and his assistant Mephistopheles convince him that he can pay off his creditors by creating paper money. It's represented as an act of pure prestidigitation.
You have plenty of gold lying around somewhere underneath your lands, notes Faust. Just issue promissory notes to your creditors that you'll give it to them later. Since no one knows how much gold there really is, there's no limit to how much you can promise.
This kind of magical language almost never appears in the Middle Ages. It would appear that it's only in a resolutely materialist age that this ability to simply produce things by saying that they're there comes to be seen as scandalous or even diabolical. And the surest sign that one has entered such a materialist age is precisely the fact that it is seen so. We've already observed Rabelais, at the very beginning of the age, reverting to language almost identical to that used by Plutarch, when he railed against moneylenders in Roman times, laughing at those natural philosophers who hold that nothing can be made of nothing, as they manipulate their books and ledgers to demand back money they never actually had. Panurge just turned it around. No, it's by borrowing that I make something out of nothing and become a kind of god. But consider the following lines, often attributed to Lord Josiah Charles Stamp, director of the Bank of England. Quote,
the modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create credit, and with the stroke of a pen they'll create enough money to buy it back again. If you wish to remain the slaves of bankers, and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let them continue to create deposits.
Unquote. It seems extremely unlikely that Lord Stamp ever really said this, but the passage has been cited endlessly. In fact, it's probably the single most often quoted passage by critics of the modern banking system. However apocryphal, it clearly strikes a chord, and apparently for the same reason. Bankers are creating something out of nothing. They're not only frauds and magicians, they're evil because they're playing God. But there's a deeper scandal here than mere prestidigitation. If medieval moralists did not raise such objections, it was not just because they were comfortable with metaphysical entities. They had a much more fundamental problem with the market. Greed. Market motives were held to be inherently corrupt. The moment that greed was validated and unlimited profit was considered a perfectly viable end in itself, this political, magical element became a genuine problem, because it meant that even those actors, the brokers, stock jobbers, traders, who effectively made the system run, had no convincing loyalty to anything, even to the system itself.